from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's downsizing, it's right-sizing, it's outsourcing, it's incoming, and it's all around us. Latest evidence, memo from Ellen McDonnell, NPR's director of morning programming, to, among other people, DeVar Ardalan. You've heard of DeVar Ardalan. Subject, saving money. As of April 1, NPR is canceling all newspaper subscriptions. We are making some arrangements to get the Wall Street Journal, either online or hard copy. You have until tomorrow to appeal this if there is a solid reason why you should be exempt. This is a cost-saving measure company-wide. So, I guess they'll have to figure out what's news some other way. The United Nations, by the way, this is your brain on the war on drugs. The United Nations says it's losing the global war on drugs. Well, you win some wars on drugs, you lose some. Anti-drug policies have, in fact, indirectly created... No. Really? Wait a minute. This calls for... This calls for this. Anti-drug policies have indirectly created a criminal market of macroeconomic size. This just in, says the UN report presented at a global drug conference in Vienna this week. The head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime said the estimated value of the illicit global drug trade had ballooned, well, it's one place they keep it, to more than $300 billion a year. Why, that's all that's keeping the world economy afloat. We need law enforcement, but the heart of the matter is to bring back health prevention treatment to the center of drugs control, said Costa. The UN General Assembly declared a war on drugs a decade ago. The European Commission said this week it had found no evidence that the global drug problem was reduced during that period. The world drug situation seems to be more or less in the same state as in 1998, says the European Union. The report noted that prices of narcotics in Western countries have fallen since 1998 by as much as 10 to 30%. Who says there's no progress? The European report said enforcing drug bans had backfired by displacing drugs traffickers to relatively lawless regions. The bans had led to addicts sharing needles, spreading diseases such as AIDS, and syringe exchange centers had been unavailable. Philip Owen, a former mayor of Vancouver, told Al Jazeera television that drug policies based on law enforcement had, quote, failed everywhere, totally failed, unquote. All right. That's your war on drugs. Now for the better side of humanity, the struggle to salute excellence and achievement among young athletes around the world. Oh, and there's also the Olympics. Chicago's efforts to host the 2016 Olympics will no longer stir the soul. That was its former motto. Now it's tagline for its attempt to hold the Olympics is, "Let friendship shine." Somebody apparently has not been waxing their friendship. The switch was made after difficulties in translating the original slogan, "Stir the soul." In a couple of different languages, it meant "stir your insides," which is not what we intended it to be, says Valerie Barker Walker, director of marketing for Chicago 2016. Is she barking or walking? She's both. With Olympic slogans, perfecting the look of translation, the look of a translation can matter as much as its content. By focusing on friendship, the new Chicago slogan reflects the lifelong bonds formed among athletes and the many ways Chicago would welcome the entire world for the Summer Games, says Barker Walker. Now she's barking. Rio de Janeiro, also a candidate for 2016. Their slogan, "Live your passion." That echoes the 2006 Winter Games in Torino. Passion lives here. Tokyo picked "Uniting Our Worlds." And Madrid says it's presenting "Games with a Human Touch." which would be a disappointment to all the machines hoping to enter. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the latest. It's not the last word, but it's the latest word. Iran lacks weapons-grade highly enriched uranium and has not yet made a decision on whether to produce any. That's the verdict of U.S. intelligence officials testifying to Congress. They also said recent Iranian missile tests were not directly related to its nuclear activities. They said the two programs were believed to be on separate development tracks. So does that settle it for now? And, see, there's this guy, A.Q. Khan, the Pakistani father of the Pakistani bomb, who proliferated techniques and materials for bomb making to, among other countries, Libya, Iran, and North Korea. And then the Pakistanis put him under house arrest, wouldn't let anybody else talk to him, and now he's free. But somebody has to be in house under house arrest in Pakistan, so now it's the leader of the opposition, because that's Newtonian law of conservation of house arrest. But anyway, this week, lawmakers in Washington introduced legislation to pressure Pakistan to allow U.S. officials for the first time to question Khan. Pakistani officials have repeatedly refused U.S. requests to interview him. But says Jane Harman, who introduced the bill, Khan is again a loose nuke scientist with proven ability to sell the worst weapons to the worst people. Our bill provides a path for the government to do the right thing, to allow the U.S. to evaluate the full extent of Khan's proliferation activities in order to halt any ongoing or future harm. And you know the Congress people mean business, because the bill includes a provision to allow the president to waive the requirement to have access to Khan if providing Pakistani aid is in the U.S. national interest. See, if we're just providing aid to Pakistan because it's not in our national interest, we can force them to let us interview Khan. Congress, meaning business every step of the way. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, here's the way. I should say this. The it's not a commonplace thing for me to play tapes or recordings of people breaking up on the air. You know, it's sort of cheap and easy. But every once in a while, a version comes along that's just sort of irresistible. About a year and a half ago, there was the very serious BBC radio newsreader who cracked up, or as they say in Britain, corpsed on the air. And then, of course, during the Paul Harvey tribute a few weeks ago, you heard Paul Harvey's one-time live announcer reduced to uncontrollable giggling. And as I say, it's cheap and it's easy, and, you know, you could fill a show every week with it. But this came in this week, and I just think it points the way.
Support for KDNK comes from Steve O'Brien, MD, and the Cosmetic Laser Center of Glenwood Medical Associates. Helping you look as young as you feel now in their expanded look.
Those are not tears. Those are tears of laughter. 9630139. Katie and Kay's spring membership drive. Like I said, Democracy Now! Costs $8,000. This is serious business. The pageantry and spectacle of the morning pledge drive here on KDNK. Please save us, 9630139.
Save us from ourselves. From
individual membership of $50 gets yours. Shrunken head, Barbie.
The shrunken head, Barbie. Can be yours for a $50 donation here at KDNK.
Played with by the ancient Mayans.
The Anasazi played with this doll.
See, now, if more pledge breaks were like that, NPR could get their newspaper subscriptions back. So please, laugh and then give. Ladies and gentlemen, how's that global war on terror going? Using phony documents and the identities of a dead man and a five-year-old boy, a government investigator obtained U.S. passports, despite post-9/11 security. Despite efforts to boost passport security since 2001, the investigator fooled passport and postal service employees on four separate applications. That's according to the Government Accountability Office. In one instance, the investigator used the social security number of a man who died in 1965, a fake New York birth certificate, and a fake Florida driver's license. He received a passport 4 days later. I'm not ticked that he received a passport, but in 4 days, real people don't get him that fast. In another attempt, the investigator used a five-year-old boy's information, but it identified himself as 53 years old on his application. He received that passport 7 days later. In another test, the investigator used fake documents to get a genuine Washington, D.C. identification card. He then used the card to apply for a passport and received it the same day. The State Department has known about this vulnerability for years. On February 26th of this year, the State Department's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Passport Services issued a memo to passport services directors across the country, stating the agency is reviewing its processes for issuing passports because of recent events. In 2009, said Brenda Sprague, passport services would focus on the quality, not the quantity, of its passport issuance decisions. Typically, passport officials are evaluated on how many passports they issue. Instead, Sprague said the specialists would focus all their efforts on improving the integrity of the process, including renewed emphasis for passport specialists on recognizing authentic documents and fraud indicators on applications. Good idea, babe. The State Department does not have the ability to ensure that supporting documents are legitimate. Yeah, I don't know how you would possibly find out that the ID that the person supplies is the ID of a dead person. I don't know how you would go about that. That bewilders me. I don't know how the State Department's supposed to figure it out. Ladies and gentlemen, it It is time now for News of the Digital Wonderland.
Harry Shearer, I'm going to get you.
I know you are, but before you get me, just do this.
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland.
Frankie writes, and he don't go to Hollywood, he just sits where he is and writes, since Channel 22, Springfield, Massachusetts, has gone digital, I am now in the market for a way to get their new signal. I currently have an old analog TV with an amplified antenna, so I thought I could go to the one store in my area that sells TVs. The store's name begins with a W. Buy a new LCD TV, hook up my antenna, and be ready to go. No way, Jose. All the LCD sets on display, they covered the back wall of the store, do not receive digital signals. They have no digital tuner built into the set, so you still need an outboard box, not for conversion of digital to analog, but reception of digital to digital. Who profits from all this confusion? The hardware vendors, all non-U.S., and their resellers, the W's of the world, says Frankie. Time Warner Cable is running a pilot program in Texas where they're metering your bandwidth usage and charging extra if you exceed your monthly allotment. This gives them the opportunity to create a tiered system where you pay more for more bandwidth. This is for people who try to escape digital television by using internet television like Hulu or Netflix video streaming or my damn channel for that matter. Congratulations to Time Warner for heading us off at the past. Past, responding to a copyright. Some residents in the Minot, North Dakota region have found the conversion to digital television to be frustrating and more expensive than anticipated. According to the Minot Daily News, this has been a nightmare, says Jim Hall, an employee at NoDak Supply in Botano, North Dakota. Not Kodak, NoDak. They have sent a number of new antennas and antenna boosters out the door since television stations began converting to digital. People are discovering they need stronger antennas to pick up a digital signal, which doesn't have the reach of the old analog signal. Digital signals are also line of sight, so terrain can interfere with reception. I think conventional analog is line of sight, too, but correct me if I'm wrong on that. On February 18th, the day after more than 400 stations in the country went all digital, nearly half of the 25,000 people who called the FCC's call center did so because of a reception or antenna problem. Roger Hall in North Dakota bought an antenna booster to try to pick up digital signals. When the converter box he purchased for his analog-only TV didn't do the trick, even the booster didn't bring in his CBS station. Because the CBS signal is still coming in analog, he's able to get a picture, but that will end June 12th. Gaines Garth Senecal, store manager at Radio Shack in Minot, said he probably could have sold three or four antennas that day if the warehouse hadn't been sold out. There's extremely high demand right now and low supply. People are frustrated, says Chad Summon in the stereo shop. They think it's something wrong with their TV, he says. Yeah, there is. I'll tell you what's wrong with their TV. It's the digital wonderland. But no, it's don't adjust your TV. There's nothing you can do now. Now, news of the warm, won't you? Yes, they're pregnant pauses. But we're taking care of them. Sending them out for adoption.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Dateline Sacramento, from agricultural losses to devastation wrought by wildfires to flooding at ports. California's economy is expected to see significant costs resulting from global warming in the decades ahead. That's according to a report presented this week. Global warming could translate into annual costs and revenue losses throughout the economy of between $2.5 billion, chicken feed these days, and $15 billion by 2050. I got that on me, babe. That's my stimulus package. No, I'm sorry. I'm just glad to see you. One assessment of future flood risk with a sea level rise projected by the year 2100 shows significant flooding is possible at California's major ports in Oakland, Los Angeles, and Long Beach. We'll move them inland to Baton Rouge. Isn't that what everybody says? Oh, no, they said that about New Orleans. The projected financial toll comes from a compilation of 40 studies commissioned by the governor's Climate Action Team. Climate Action Team, take word. The final reports distributed at the end of this month are intended to provide a comprehensive snapshot of global warming's potential costs to California. The numbers indicate we have a lot at stake, says Michael Hanneman, professor in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley. Californians need to pay serious attention to control our greenhouse gas emissions, and they need to start thinking about adaptation. All right, I'm going to option the novel and adapt it. Amid all the forecasts, and this is still News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, the award-winning News of the Warm, amid all the forecasts and warnings of doom and disaster issued by climate scientists, there's the hidden message that all is not yet lost, reports the Times of London's environmental reporter. Ice sheets are melting and ocean acidity is rising, yet most scientists still believe global warming can be controlled. Climate researchers are clear that the problem keeps deepening. They believe, though, these scientists, as a statement issued at the end of a three-day conference in Copenhagen this week made clear, that most of the tools and technology needed to bring down greenhouse gas emissions are available or at least under development. Yeah, well, give us a call when that. Professor Catherine Richardson of U Copenhagen organized the conference. I have great faith in humans, she says. Well, that's your first mistake. And their ability to regulate their relationship with the planet that we live on. Many of the scientists at the conference cited the recession as an ideal opportunity to turn the global economy green. Good luck to them. The world's leading scientists, this is also from that conference, have issued a desperate plea to politicians to act on climate change amid warnings that without action the world faces decades of social unrest and war. Because we have such faith in humans. In what was described as a watershed moment, more than 2,500 leading environmental experts agreed on a statement that called on governments to act before the planet becomes an unrecognizable and places impossible place to live. This was an emergency climate summit in Copenhagen, and scientists agreed that worst-case scenarios are becoming reality and dangerous climate change is imminent unless drastic action is taken soon. It's a strongly worded message, unusually for academics. It appealed directly to politicians. They said there was no excuse for inaction and that weak and ineffective governments must stand up to big business and vested interests. Steps should be vigorously and widely implemented, they said, to reduce greenhouse gases. Failure to do so would result in significant risk of irreversible climate shifts, they said. Lord Stern, the former chief economist of the World Bank, said the politicians continue to underestimate the impact of climate change and scientists need to redouble their efforts to get them to understand. Much of southern Europe would look like the Sahara, he said. So stretch your blanket out. There's plenty of room. And also from that conference, by the end of the century, sea levels may rise twice as much as was predicted just 2 years ago. This means the lives of some 600 million people living on low-lying islands or lying on low-living islands, as well as those living in Southeast Asia's populous delta areas, well, they should just move to Shreveport. They will be put at serious risk if climate change is not quickly and radically mitigated. The seas are undergoing much greater changes than those described in the International Panel on Climate Change, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report from just 2 years ago, says Eric Ringno, one of the study's authors, the new study. He's professor of Earth System Science at UC Irvine. This is the crux of the problem. 2 or 3 years ago, those making this type of statement were seen as extremists. The upper range now in the rise of sea levels could be approximately a meter, 3.28 feet, put the converter away. At the lower end of the spectrum, it appears increasingly unlikely that sea level rise will be much less than a half meter by 2100. Low-lying coastal areas house 1 in 10 humans. They will be hit hard, even in a best-case scenario, if greenhouse gas emissions are not reduced quickly and substantially. Sea levels have been continuing to rise since 1993 at a rate well above average for the 20th century, says John Church of the Center for Australian Weather and Climate Research. The oceans are continuing to warm and expand. The melting of mountain glaciers has increased, and the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica are also contributing to rising sea levels. Years ago, says Ringno, the science community believed the Antarctic did not affect sea levels substantially. Today we have results demonstrating that what is happening down there is as significant as is Greenland's ongoing ice loss. By down there, he means Antarctica. Don't get worried. You're fine. And the scientific community is now more fully aware that ice sliding into the ocean as opposed to melting plays a preponderant role in ice cap evolution. Ice is slipping to the ocean at a rapid rate, a phenomenon that was not correctly incorporated into previous models. Finally, ocean acidification driven by climate change is stripping away the protective shell of tiny yet vital organisms that absorb huge amounts of carbon pollution from the atmosphere, according to a new study. The calcium carapace of microscopic animals called foraminifera, who live in the Southern Ocean. That carapace has fallen in weight by a third, this new study finds. The amoeba-like organisms about the size of a grain of sand live in the surface waters of oceans around the world. They're an important part of the ecological chain and also provide a bulwark against global warming. They transform CO2 from the air into calcium-based shells. When they die, their carbon-rich shells sink to the ocean floor, storing the CO2 forever. Previous studies have shown that other marine animals, notably corals, are losing their ability to form exoskeletons from calcium. But this is the first study to look specifically at acidification and pin it to greenhouse gas pollution. It is the invasion of anthropogenic, man-made CO2 that is causing this particular source of acidification, says one of the authors. All right, then. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. We are so helping the Iraqis. Dick Cheney on CNN, on one of the Sunday Yak shows, says we've accomplished all of our goals in Iraq. And this wasn't even announced as one of our goals, but this from a news conference this week from an American spokesman. The good news about Iraq. Ooh.
Beyond education and culture in the field of economy and services, it's worth noting that representatives of U.S. banks, J.P. Morgan and Citibank and others that came to Baghdad on January 28th, participated in an international banking conference. They explored correspondent banking relations that would deepen commercial ties between Iraq and the international community, business community. Citibank has already established correspondent relationship services agreement with Iraq's Warka Bank that allows clients of both banks to execute cash payments, wire transfers, and trade transactions to both corporate and retail entities in all Iraq's cities and provinces.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Citibank is teaching the Iraqis how to do banking, helping them out because maybe they'd like some toxic assets, you know? Just give the toxic assets to the Iraqis. Say, you got it, babe. You're welcome. And clear off the balance sheets just like that, don't you think? We learned this week that Scholastic magazines, you know, the ones that are given to kids in schools, they don't make kids pay for those yet, do they? Yet. Is explaining the current economic meltdown by saying it's the product of good intentions. All right? That's one attempt. Larry Summers, President Obama's top economic advisor, tried another tack this week. They're now trying to talk up the economy. By the way, speaking of which, Jim Cramer, who notably had that contretemps with Jon Stewart this week on cable TV, Cramer said a week ago, we have to judge Obama harshly. The stock market's going down. Yes. That's a plebiscite on Obama. This week, stock market went up 4 out of 5 days. Jim? So Larry Summers, Obama's top economic advisor, talking up the economy, or trying to, says that even though the country's current recent excessive optimism may have helped trigger the current recession, the resulting lack of confidence is now hurting chances of recovery. Instead of an expectation of new buyers, there is an expectation of new sellers. Greed gives way to fear, and this fear begets fear, says Summers. This is the paradox at the heart of the financial crisis. In the past few years, he says, we've seen too much greed and too little fear. Too much spending and not enough saving, too much borrowing and not enough worrying. Today, however, he says, our problem is exactly the opposite. It is this transition from an excess of greed to an excess of fear that President Roosevelt had in mind when he, you know, did the famous quote. He says the country now must find a way to overcome its fears if it's to overcome the current downturn. Where the Dow Jones is now, it's the sale of the century. The stock market is the sale of the century, he says. So, a little more complex than Scholastic. Maybe we need to just kind of boil that down.
Gather around, children, sit right here. Gonna tell you a story about what we see. A little bit greed, a little bit fear. How it tastes all depends on the recipe. How it tastes all depends on the recipe. A few years back we were making a mint. The only thing we feared was reading fine print. Breed was king, bling was a queen. Automatic was the setting on the wealth machine. Automatic was the setting on the wealth machine. You could flip your house, you could flip the whole street. You could flip the ass off of anyone you'd meet. Yeah, flipping was tripping, stocks were gold. Watch TV for a day, you'd have the thing down cold. Watch TV for a day, you'd have the thing down cold. Now, credit was easy. They sent you cards in the mail. You could get a mortgage while you were sitting in jail. Wi-Fi was sweet, but refi was sweeter. Death-defying finance was the greed repeater. Yeah, death-defying finance was the greed repeater. Gather around, children, sit right here. Gonna tell you a story about what we see. A little bit greed, a little bit fear. How it tastes all depends on the recipe. How it tastes all depends on the recipe. That sleepy old bank, now it had game. Buying back a slice and hedging its bet at 1/30th the price. Hedging its bet at a fraction of the price. Now bankers and brokers, they were itching to merge. In the middle of a binge, who thinks about the purge? Money went round to circle the globe. Nobody asked for one damn probe. Single pro. Now maybe you had a friend of a friend, got you in a deal with profits no end. Guy was kinda secret, fund was kinda hush. All you knew was that it made you feel so flush. All you knew was that it made you feel so flush. Fear was in the backseat, maybe the trunk. Everyone knew how to make gold out of junk. Who could have known, who could have seen, that snake oil lubricated the wealth machine? It was snake oil lubricated the wealth machine. Gather round, children, sit right here. Gonna tell you a story about what we see. Gas. Someone pulled the handbrake, the tires ate glass. We're losing our jobs, we're losing our mojo. We canceled the Ritz and we canceled the Hojo. We canceled the Ritz and we canceled the Hojo. You can't get credit if you're the freaking Pope. The guys who said yes are now programmed for nope. Is worth less than your 60-inch screen. Upside down, underwater, living the dream. Upside down, underwater, and living the dream. are scary, the opinions are worse. The wealth machine turns out to look a lot like a hearse. The bankers are begging, the beggars are sore. The going out of business sailors emptied the store. The going out of business sailors emptied the store. The only greed's in the vultures buying houses for dimes. Fear's in the driver's seat, fear writes the rhymes. Fear doesn't strike out, it hits a grand slam. Your fear is the reality, its greed looks like a scam. Fear is the reality, and greed is the scam. So gather round, children, sit right here. Gonna tell you a story of what we see. Little bit greed, little bit fear. How it tastes all depends on the recipe. How it tastes all depends on the recipe. Fear begets fear, hope begets hope. Why do you think they call it dope? Stimulus and bailouts to those outstretched hands. CDOs and swaps, hey, no one understands. Yeah, CDOs and swaps that no one understands. They're telling us to balance the greed and the fear. Stocks are now a bargain, happy days are here. But the truth is more elusive than a well-paying job. You can't have mob behavior unless you got a mob. No, you can't have mob behavior unless you've got a mob.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the Independent in London, secret British government emails released this week provide damning new evidence that the notorious dossier making the case for invading Iraq in Britain was, as it was alleged at the time by a BBC reporter, fired for saying these words, quote, sexed up, unquote. Not sextuplets, sexed up. They disclosed the intelligence services were skeptical over the iffy drafting of government claims that Saddam Hussein could mount a missile strike on his neighbors within 45 minutes of ordering an attack. Officials privately mocked assertions that the Iraqi president was covertly trying to develop a nuclear capability and wisecracked that perhaps he'd recruited Dr. Frankenstein to his supposed crack team of nuclear scientists. That's good fun. The release of the series of confidential memos and emails follow a protracted Freedom of Information battle and reignite the controversy over accusations that Tony Blair's government spun Britain into war. By the way, the Downing Street memos say, according to the head of MI5 or MI6, British intelligence official who was in Washington meeting with the Bush administration in July of 2002, that they were fixing the intelligence to match the policy. Just two-letter difference between fixing up and sexing up. But oh, those two letters. From The Guardian, it's not what you'd call chic. Chunky, square-toed, shiny leather upper, thick polyurethane sole available in black, brown, camel, sand, all cotton line, surprisingly light, a mere 300 grams each. Designed and produced for comfort, above all, particularly popular in the Middle East. Ramazan Badan himself designed this model, number 271, in 1999. Since then, it's never been out of production. We design up to 300 models a year, says the export manager for Baydan Shoes of Istanbul. We produce maybe 150. No other shoe has stayed 10 years in the range. For the first few years of its life, model 271 with added sheepskin lining was big in Russia and the Ukraine. As that market dried up, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon took over. Priced at just $27 a pair wholesale, maybe $40 retail, the shoe had been a steady earner. Baydan's Iraqi distributor could be relied on for 20,000 pairs a year. The rest of the region took the same, a few thousand sold in the U.S. Then, on December 14th last year, an Iraqi TV reporter stood up in the middle of a news conference at Baghdad, yelled, "This is a gift from the Iraqis. This is the farewell kiss, you dog," and lobbed two battered 271s at the head of George W. Bush. Model 271, spotted on the endlessly repeated video footage by Baydan's man in Baghdad, later positively ID'd by the designer himself, has become a star among shoes. Says the designer, "There's no doubt. How could I mistake my own model? It's like my child." Orders have poured in from Iraq, the rest of the Arab world, Europe, 90,000 pairs alone, and the U.S. Individual purchases via the company's website are booming, says Baydan, a sleek and smiling figure. "People want them as a souvenir for themselves or as gifts. It's quite the thing." Orders are up over 500% over last year. Some 450,000 extra pairs of Model 271 will soon be walking the earth. Baydan has taken on subcontractors to help the 25 workers in his own factory. "We are just humble shoemakers. We know nothing about politics. Above all, we see such a business as an honor for our shoe." Model 271 has been hastily renamed Model Bye Bye Bush, and the trade name registered. A smart gold label is now glued to the shoe's tongue. The company's website has been redesigned in English, Bye Bye Bush, which expressed itself with the slogan, "Not all people can affect history," makes an ironic reference to Bush, who had negative reflections in history, also functioned as symbol expressing the reactions against Bush in the world. There's a quote from the English. That's English. Four pairs of shoes have been rushed to Hollywood at the request of an American film company. Always quick to jump on something hot, the American film industry. An animated movie about the shoe? The little shoe that could get thrown at the president's head? The belief, says Mark Lieberman, a linguistics professor at the University of Pennsylvania, that has long been a custom in England, Scotland, and elsewhere to throw an old shoe at the bride and groom when they leave the bride's home after the wedding breakfast or when they go to the church to get married, coming from the belief that throwing old shoes is a way to bring good luck. And then there's, of course, shoe-fiti, in which shoes whose laces have been tied together are flung so they hang from power lines. No one knows what this custom actually means, says The Guardian. Oh, yeah? Check Snopes.com. And Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States attacked Western I don't know if it's real that means a drug deal was conducted on that corner or not. That's why I'm saying check Snopes.com. Let me know. Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States attacked Western governments fighting in and providing billions in aid to his country this week, saying those who claim the international community is not winning the war should, quote, should know they never fully tried, unquote. We never asked to be the 51st state, says Ambassador Saeed Jawad. To suggest Afghans do not deserve peace, pluralism, and human rights is wrong and racist, he says. He says negotiations with the Taliban should be conducted by the Afghan government and withheld until it was in a position of strength. Jawad's remarks came in an address at Harvard this week. He accused those aiding Afghanistan of total negligence in building the Afghan police force and judicial system under investment in the National Army and providing meager resources to helping the government deliver services and protect its citizens. $173 billion U.S. in Afghanistan since 2001. I know. It's a drop in the bucket. Enough to restore the coastal wetlands of Louisiana, rebuild the levee system in New Orleans, and all the other levee systems at all the other cities that depend on the Corps of Engineers for their safety throughout this country. What? Who said that? Many of Jawad's complaints echo assessments made by the Obama administration, blaming its predecessor and blaming Karzai. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast.
Operator, up in heaven, won't you please do something special just for me? 'Cause I've been wanting for a long, long time to holler up at a partner of mine. See, I already got the number, I just need the new area code. 'Cause 949-0344. Every time I dial it up, it don't wanna work no more. Operator.
Oh, operator.
Operator. Straight too far. He's getting down in the bar with Johnny Guitar. Operator,
oh, operator.
Well, now, operator,
oh, operator.
I already got the number, I just need a new area code. I already got your number, I just need a new area code. Got your number, just need a new area code.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
You know about the big bonuses being paid by AIG after it took $185 billion in federal money. Well, that's enough to do it wrong in Afghanistan. Now, here comes Swedish bank SEB, whose CEO, Annika Falkengren, apologized to the bank's customers, employees, after the outcry that followed a decision to hike executive pay. SEB executives will now forego the pay rises. It all went very wrong, Falkengren said. The Swedish prime minister was among the large number of customers, staff, politicians, and shareholders that were vocal in their condemnation of the decision to raise executive pay. It feels very easy to apologize to our customers, but most of all, I would like to apologize to my colleagues. We were wrong. The intentions were good, but it all went very wrong. In response to a question as to whether the episode indicated the bank had lost contact with reality, Falkengren replied, yes, in the sense that we were unable to explain that the total remuneration actually declined. Good night. Students at a New York middle school were alarmed by an embarrassing surprise when they mistakenly received condoms at a local school health fair. Students at Clinton Middle School say they were shocked when several classmates found condoms yesterday in their goodie bags given out at a school health fair. The Ryan Community Health Center gave out the bags as part of an HIV/AIDS awareness program and apologized for the mistake in a statement to local Channel 2. This was an unfortunate error. We're taking steps with our staff to ensure it does not happen again. Bad goodie bag. Even amid all the financial turmoil, the Los Angeles Dodgers stood out last season for one of the worst investments in recent memory. They signed Andrew Jones for $36.2 million and were rewarded with a 158 average, three homers, just 75 games from an outfielder with a bloated belly. Well, Jones has since restored his athletic physique, moved on to the Texas Rangers. This week, he hit a spring training home run against the Dodgers. But now, Jones says, I'm sorry I didn't stand up to my reputation. I'm sorry for what I put everyone through. I'm sorry I did not make it work. Should talk to Tim Gunn about that. He can make it work. Added Jones, last season was the worst year of my life by far. I got off on everybody's bad side. I couldn't turn it around. It really hurt. Dodger fans consistently booed Jones, who for some reason thought that playing with an extra 25 pounds would be a good idea. I know I was heavy, says Jones. I thought it would be okay. The president of Indonesia, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, apologized to the people of Pangkajene Islands, South Sulawesi, for failing to inaugurate a number of projects this week. He didn't show up due to gastritis. Not gas prices, gastritis. Deadline Grand Rapids, Michigan. Kent County Commissioner James Vaughn made a public apology to the County Board of Commissioners after being convicted for an assault in June of last year. He was found guilty of aggravated assault and domestic violence. He and his friend Cassandra Mitchell were charged for an attack on another woman who refused to engage in a sexual three-way with them. Here's Vaughn's statement. I'd like to apologize to the constituents and my colleagues on the board for any embarrassment this situation has created. I've always attempted to represent my district and the county in a positive manner. My desire is to continue to serve my constituents and the public. Again, my sincere and genuine apologies. Vaughn faces up to a year in jail. Both charges are misdemeanors. He does not risk losing his county commission seat. He said he has no plans to step down after his conviction. Because, you know, sexual assault helps broaden his background into dealing with the problem. No, it doesn't. Okay. And how about the bassist for rock group Korn? I said Korn. Bassist Fieldy has released a book, Got the Life, My Journey of Addiction, Faith, Recovery, and Korn. This week. The book includes letters he wrote to each band member apologizing for his past behavior as an alcoholic. He didn't give them the letters privately because he wanted to be open about his sobriety. He struggled with alcohol, drugs, and overeating. He would even eat food off other people's used room service trays.
Unlike a certain Dodger.
Even trash cans. He quit cold turkey when his father, a born-again Christian, told him his dying wish was for his son to find God. Yes, that's right. God needs to be found. A Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer has apologized to the widow of a skier who died while stranded in the British Columbia backcountry after the Mounties failed to launch a search when it learned of an SOS message in the snow. So, no, they don't, always. Hey, how's the Octomom doing? Two of her octuplets are expected to come home as early as Monday.
And as she waded through ongoing construction while touring her new 2,500-square-foot home, she apologized to her neighbors. "I never wanted this," she said. "I never thought it would be more than one baby." "Then why did you have 85,000 implanted into you, lady?" "I never thought it would be more than one baby, and I'm sorry it's going to bring this much attention." She also said, "I'm never going to get pregnant again," and that she'd gained 130 pounds and would like to drop 50. Well, I think there's 50 excess pounds of collagen on those lips. Dateline London tabloid weekly magazine OK has apologized to Victoria Beckham for cutting and pasting her on its cover with Girls Aloud's Cheryl Cole. The British edition of the magazine issued an apology to the former Spice Girl after they were asked to clarify the photo they used on their February 10th issue. Bishop David Zubik of the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh will hold a prayer service April 7th to apologize to anyone who's ever been hurt by someone acting in the name of the Catholic Church. How could that be? "If you've been harmed by the Church in any way, I invite you to come. There'll be nothing expected of you but your willingness to pray with me. No one will bother you," Bishop Zubik wrote, except for a certain old priest. No, he didn't say that. And for the second time in less than 3 weeks, Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky has apologized for something he says he shouldn't have said. The Republican said he was sorry for swearing at reporters when he was asked in a conference call about the results of a campaign poll he had commissioned. "I'm sorry for taking the Lord's name in vain," Bunning said in a statement. "After 59 years of dealing with the media, sometimes they get under your skin, but that is no excuse." On February 23rd, he issued an apology for saying at a Kentucky fundraiser that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be dead within a year. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, and speaking of Catholic prelates, Pope Benedict XVI this week apologized for mistakes that he deeply regretted in a letter attempting to quiet that storm of protest over his embrace of an excommunicated bishop who denied that Nazis killed Jews in gas chambers. That should clear it all up. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz, shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/the show, available as a free podcast at kcrw.com, now available on your iPhone via the free app Wonder Radio. Man, and it would be just like the whole excommunicated bishop thing being solved, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Already, thank you very much. By the way, check out unwigged.com for info on that big Unwigged tour coming up later this year. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. And thanks, as always, to the Chicago, Hawaii, San Diego, and Pittsburgh guests and Pam Halstead. See you next week.